Thank you. Yes, I want to thank the organizer for this opportunity to talk here. And before I start, I want to mention also that most of the results that I will show here are the achieved during my PhD with Professor Aran Sharon and Professor Raz Cooperman, but I will also focus at the end on an undergoing research with Professor Mark Boyk from Syracuse and Professor David Nelson from Harvard. And the first thing that I want to do is to explain what I mean by saying elastic charges. So it is clear to all of you that elasticity is a special case of continuum field theory. And in most continuum field theories, the notion of charge is clear, for example, in electricity. The electric charge is a singularity that is a source for the scalar field of the electric potential. So when we can already intuitively say that elastic charges will be singular sources of deformation. And having this in mind, although it can be in any dimensions, I will limit this talk to two dimensions because of two reasons. First, because the two-dimensional case is much more rich. And second, it is much more simple to explain. But most of the results can be generalized. There are some results that will be much difficult to generalize, but still the generalization can be made. So we can, probably the most famous notion of charge is known from defects in crystalline materials. Crystalline materials are ordered structures. And defects are deviations of the material from its ordered state. And these kinds of singularities in a coarse-grained picture act as source of deformations or source of stresses. So there are the well-known disclinations that are monopoles-like and dislocations that are dipole of disclinations. But there are other systems that involve elastic charges. For example, contractile cells that are adhered to an elastic substrate, when they apply traction, they deform the elastic substrate. And again, in a coarse-grained picture, it can be regarded as a singular source of deformation and therefore as elastic charge. Another example is of plastic deformations. Here you see an illustration of an amorphous solid that is subjected to external shear. If the shear is small enough, the material responds elastically, meaning that if you remove the shear, it returns to its original state. But if the shear exceeds some threshold, then suddenly small regions can rearrange, forming localized plastic deformations. And then if you remove the shear, the material will not return to its original state. And in this sense, these small regions act, again, as sources of deformations and therefore as elastic charges. At last, it is a slightly different example to be illustrated here. This is a uniform sheet that is subjected to small external stress. In this case, you expect for a uniform deformation of the sheet. But if you now introduce a small hole, then the profile of the stress around this hole will be non-trivial. And in some sense that I will explain later, we will be able to describe the hole as some type of elastic charge. So this is the motivation, but you notice that in all these examples, I considered only isolated elastic charges. Most interesting cases involve many of them. For example, here you can see a picture taken from work by Ariel Livne and co-workers. You have a large set of contractile cells. They apply tractions, and each of them therefore deform the elastic substrate, and they interact mechanically this way. And they show a very non-trivial collective behavior that is governed by the interactions between these elastic charges. Another example is complex defects. The one that I showed you, the disclinations and dislocation, are very simple, but sometimes you can find complicated defects, and the interaction between them can be very important if you want to understand the plastic behavior of crystals or their electronic behavior. This picture is of an amorphous metal that was subjected to a large compression, and for very large compression, the metal fails, it breaks along a plane that is 45 degrees with the respect to the external compression, And recently it was suggested that the failure mechanism is governed by the interaction between localized plastic deformations, which are similar to the one that I illustrated in the previous slide. And therefore, again, the interaction between elastic charges can be important also for failure of amorphous solids. And if you take my word that the hole can be considered as elastic charge, then it will be also relevant for the problem of kirigami, where you have an array of holes, and single holes by themselves does not change the picture very much, but when you have an array of special arrays of holes, then the response of elastic material can dramatically change, like in this example. Now, in this context, I want to mention the talk of Andre. Last week, Andre mentioned this problem with a very good motivation. In his beautiful talk, he mentioned the mechanics of ribbons. And you can see that kirigami structures can be considered as a set of ribbons connected in some non-trivial way. And if you want to understand the statistics of such bodies, it will be probably be useful first to understand the mechanics of single ribbons. What I suggest, and I will explain it later, is not to refer to this object as a set of ribbons, but as a set of holes that interact with each other, and I'll try to explain it at the end of the talk. So what I'm going to do, I will start with explaining the formalism so the language will be clear, and then I will refer to the geometry and the mechanics of the elastic charges that I mentioned. And at the end, I will mention the fictitious elastic charges that are related to the holes. Okay, so I will adopt a geometric formulation of elasticity, and there is an immediate question, why? Why shouldn't I use the classical theory of elasticity? And the answer is that these elastic charges act as sources for residual stresses. Stresses will appear in the system in the absence of any boundary conditions. And the formulation, or the geometric formulation of elasticity, as I will show in a minute, naturally captures the notion of residual stresses in terms of geometric incompatibility, and this is what I'm going to explain now. So we know that elasticity theory is eventually about local deviations of the distances between neighboring material elements from their reference values. So this is what elasticity is all about. So the geometric tool with which we measure distances is the metric tensor. So we model an elastic body as a manifold equipped with a reference metric. The reference metric measures the local equilibrium distances between material elements. Now, as I mentioned, I will focus on two-dimensional problems, meaning that our universe and our materials are two-dimensional, so we are interested in two-dimensional configuration. So a configuration will be an embedding of this manifold into the Euclidean plane. And given the configuration, it induces an actual metric, an actual distance between neighboring material elements. And now we have two metrics, the actual one, which describes actual distances, and the reference one, which describes the reference one. So we can define the strain tensor as the difference between the two metric tensors. Now, given a configuration, we want to associate an energy with this configuration, an elastic energy. So it is commonly written in this term as an additive measure of local energetic cost. And this W is positive definite, and it is zero only if G equal to G bar. So if G equal to G bar, we don't have strain, we want to say that the elastic energy is zero. The exact form of W reflects the elastic properties of the material and its symmetries, but the result that I will show you are independent of the exact form of W.
So we are really thinking of 3D objects at that time.
We don't need to. We can think about two-dimensional objects that are in the plane.
Okay.
Yes. You can also think about three-dimensional body that is translationally invariant under in one direction, and it is thick, so it doesn't bend, and it is therefore effectively two-dimensional problem. Okay.
So your W can be zero if and only if G
equal to G bar. Yes.
Okay. So
if G is different from G bar, okay, it means that the actual distance between material element is different from the reference value, and I want to associate with it an energetic cost.
Okay. So by definition.
Yes.
Also, you need to worry about inversions, right? This energy doesn't penalize sort of the material folding back on itself in R2.
folding back to itself, what do you mean?
You take a sheet of paper and you fold it as a map into R2.
So this is why I'm saying that I'm thinking about a real two-dimensional universe. And when you talk about inversions, you need probably to, it is, you cannot approach this configuration without getting very small distances between. So if I have two particles, I want to take this into here. In three dimensions, I can do this without paying lots of energy. In two dimensions, I must go through it. Or
sure.
Yes. Yeah, so if I will want to describe something that prevents it, I will need to pay lots of energy when it's too close. So who can? Energy will not be enough. I will need something that, for example, the Hankey energy, which is logarithmic, and where you, when two particles reach one each other, you pay infinite energy. So it will be prevented. But I'm not worrying about it. I will not study this kind of configurations, and it is possible to include the high energetic cost for this kind of deformations.
I think, are you saying that you're not talking about this whole sequence of some continuous deformation? You're talking about a single map from.
So given a map, I'm this energy functional asks only about how local deformations deviate, and it doesn't ask about topology or large reflections that can be very costly on a smaller.
So the problem is, sure, this might not be an issue for what you're talking about, but that energy as itself, it is not well posed because it allows deformations that are locally isometric, but that, you know, do this thing of within R2. Shrinking.
Yes, you are right. So, yes, you are right. If I want to prevent, to do some dynamics, for example, and to prevent from such a deformation to occur, I need to modify this energy.
So the whole discussion is because the integral is over dV. That's why.
No, the integral just depends on G and G bar.
And not on configuration, for example. It doesn't care about configuration. We skip the, it doesn't, okay, so. A configuration can be isometric to G bar, but with large deformations, like reflections, for example. So this doesn't take it into account. Yes.
Just to make sure I understand, so for an experimental point of view, the operation somehow is like crushing.
I will, in a minute, I will show. Yes. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So, as I mentioned, in cases that I will need to explicitly calculate something, I will assume the simplest Hookean constitutive relation, which means that the energy density is quadratic in the strain, but most of the results are independent of this. And yes, so now I assume that there are too many words here and too less figures, and I want to give some intuition. So about your question, you can think about this reference manifold as two-dimensional surface. The reference metric describes the distances between the neighboring elements in the surface, and given a coordinate system, if you have two neighboring points, then the reference metric describes this length element. Okay? So we are interested in planar configurations of our reference manifold, so you can take this manifold and flatten it between these two plates, and now you have flat configuration. Now, in practice, this can be made experimentally, but in practice, if you have three-dimensional solid, as I mentioned, it can be flat, effectively two-dimensional because of thickness. If you have thick body that is translationally symmetric along the direction, it is equivalent. The problem is effectively two-dimensional. And the question now, okay, so in practice, we may have a different length elements that are described by the actual metric. And the question now is, in which situations G can be equal to G bar? And in which situations it cannot, okay? So to answer this question, we need a very simple classical result from geometry, is that if you have two manifolds, two general manifolds, two-dimensional one, and you want to embed one inside the other isometrically, meaning without in-plane deformations, then you can do it if and only if they have the same curvature. Now, in our story, we have two curvatures. We have the intrinsic Gaussian curvature that can be calculated from the reference metric, and we have the actual curvature, which is zero, because we are interested in planar configurations. So if for example the reference metric is Euclidean, you can take a paper which is look like a cylinder. It has a Euclidean metric, so you can flatten it in the plane without deformations. Therefore, this is because the reference curvature is zero. And in this case, we say that the intrinsic geometry is compatible with the plane, with the extrinsic geometry, without deformations.
Without external loads.
Everything is, I assume no boundary conditions, free boundary conditions, and it can also be generalized for other boundary conditions, but this is for free boundary conditions.
So this condition is necessary, is it also sufficient?
In simply connected manifolds, it is sufficient.
It's free boundary.
Yes.
So you say they curvature is identical.
So I said we have two curvatures in our story. We have the intrinsic geometry that describes the distances. I'm not talking about external curvature. I have two-dimensional manifold. It is equipped with a metric, and now you can calculate from this metric the Gaussian curvature. It is a scalar number.
You're talking about Gauss.
Yes. So two manifolds can be isometrically embedded if their Gaussian curvature are the same. So if the reference metric is Euclidean, you can embed the material in the plane isometrically without deformations. But if the reference metric is not Euclidean, its reference curvature is non-zero, then you have an incompatibility, geometric incompatibility. And this implies that the reference curvature is a source for residual stresses. And in this sense, this takes us back.
I think you didn't mention something you might think is trivial, that there is a connection between the metric and the Gaussian curvature.
So I think I said it, that the Gaussian curvature is calculated from the metric. So given a metric, you can calculate its Gaussian curvature. And we have two metrics, the reference and the actual one. You can calculate the Gaussian curvature from each of them. And if they are equal, they are isometric. And if not, they are not. And this is, again, for simply connected manifolds. And this implies, again, that the reference curvature is the source for incompatibility, and therefore this is a good candidate for describing elastic charges. And the elastic problem now is you give me the elastic energy functional, and you give me the reference metric. In order to solve the problem, we need to minimize this energy with respect to G under the requirement that G describes planar configurations in our problem. Now, there are two questions. First, what is the reference metric G bar that can describe elastic charge? This is a geometric question. And the second question is mechanical. Assuming that we have a reference metric that describes elastic charge, how can this energy be minimized in practice? So this takes us to the first question about geometry of elastic charges, and I will skip the derivation, which I find nice, but it is not really necessary. I can just give you the answer. How to find the reference metric of elastic charge? So if we assume that the reference curvature is the source of... Okay, we saw that reference curvature is the source for incompatibility, so we will define elastic charges as singularity of the reference curvature. So we can have many types of singularities. D is a differential operator. So for the monopole, for example, D will be just a scalar number, Q. For a dipole singularity, we will have a first derivative of the delta function, and we can have multiples of elastic charges. So the question is, what can we write reference metric that describe these singularities? And the answer is yes. This is the reference Gaussian curvature, the curvature of the reference metric. Okay? So, yes?
I just want to point something out, that in case you are talking to a elasticity engineering mechanics audience as opposed to physics audience, there's a potential for confusion here in the use of the term compatibility. So I mean, what you're talking about here is presumably singular solutions to the Gauss equation or something like that, which has a nice analogy with electrostatics. The compatibility between Gaussian curvatures is what you're referring to, I think, when you say compatibility. The term compatibility is often used in elasticity to talk about the relationship between a strain tensor and an embedding vector.
So what I offer here is an alternative description of what is compatibility. So compatibility, two materials are compatible if you can, a material is compatible if it can be free from stresses, and it is incompatible if not. And this is an alternative description of the same thing. And we can talk about it if you want about finding the.
So compatibility here is talking about if you have a strain tensor, can that actually be derived from an embedding vector? So that's how the term is generally used. And when you, there are cases where you can exam, for example, describe dislocations in solids as singular solutions of a compatibility equation, which enforces that connection. So it has more to do with the concept of torsion, I think, than with curvature.
The torsion tensor, you talk about the torsion tensor. We can talk about it later, and I will show you that this describes the same thing, the same notion of compatibility. But I don't want to waste too much time on it because here I can forget about the classical one.
But go ahead.
I can forget about the classical one and tell you that when I'm talking about compatibility, I mean that the question is geometric one. The question is, our manifold, is it compatible with the plane geometrically? Can it be embedded in the plane isometrically? This is the definition of this compatibility, and later we can talk about how it relates with classical compatibility conditions or definitions. Okay, so the question is, can we write reference metric of these curvatures, these types of curvatures, and the answer is yes. If we adopt a conformal representation of the metric tensor, this is the Euclidean metric in polar coordinates. We can write a multiple expansion of the metric, where this is the conformal factor. This term, for example, corresponds to a monopole of curvature. It corresponds to a delta function. The second term corresponds to the dipole. And we have many types of possible elastic charges. So now, if I want to solve the problem of a dipole of declinations, the elastic problem, it is defined. I have a reference metric with a conformal factor with n equal 1, and the elastic problem now is minimize the elastic energy with respect to g, where g bar is given in this by this expression.
So if you have your singularities at distinct points?
Okay, I'll talk about it. Okay, so now the question is, okay, so what is the geometric meaning of each of these multiples? So to answer this question, an easy way to do it is to ask, let's assume that we have the monopole, only the monopole, so phi equal to alpha log r. What is the isometric embedding of this, of a manifold with this metric in the plane? So I mentioned at the beginning that there probably will be no isometric embedding because this is a source for the formations. So if you will start with the monopole, you find that the isometric embedding requires a radial cut, and you find this configuration, which is just a declination. You have an angular deficit, and this is exactly what is observed in crystals as a declination. So the monopole, the delta function of the reference curvature, corresponds to a declination. Similarly, the dipole now, you will not surprise it if the dipole of declination is just a dislocation. And if you find, you calculate the isometric embedding of the manifold with this metric, you find this configuration which corresponds exactly to the classical Volterra constructions of defects, of dislocations. And surprisingly, the quadrupolar term, the next term, does not require any radial cut. It can be achieved by local plastic deformation. Here you can see in crystals it is known that quadrupole can be achieved by rotating a single bond. And an isometric embedding of the metric of a quadrupole shows that indeed it deforms only locally. So if you want to induce the metric of a quadrupole, you should only deform this inner shape to a circle, and then your material will be residually stressed with a effective singularity of a quadrupole. Now, the question is,
can you remind me, quadrupole the same thing as an interstitial or vacancy?
No, it is the same order, but I can say a word about it in a minute. I just want to say is, okay, everybody knows about defects in crystals, so why is it good for? Why do we need to have metric description of defects that everybody knows how to deal with? So the answer is that this description of the metric description of defects or elastic charges is not limited for crystalline solids. you can now describe this location in an amorphous solid. So although there is no underlying order, it is well defined. If the metric structure is of this type, you have an amorphous solid with a dislocation. So again, the examples that I showed at the beginning with the contractile cells or localized plastic deformations in amorphous solid, they are all of the same nature. They are singularities of the reference curvature, and they are simply elastic charges. While in crystals, you can observe them. In amorphous solids, they are there, although you cannot see them. Yeah.
So there's this whole literature about using geometric methods to talk about defects.
With the torsion tensor?
Yeah.
I can talk about it. Okay. First, I will answer the previous question, and then I will refer to this. So the previous question was about interstitial. So interstitial is like taking an extra particle and put it inside the lattice, and then it's like it's pushing outside. Okay? So in this case, this is a different type of singularity. This is a delta function singularity. This is a derivative. This is the second derivative. The interstitial is also second derivative, but it is simply a Laplacian of the delta function. It is also included in this formalism, and it is a legitimate defect in this sense. Now, the torsion.
But this
will be the isotropic. In some sense, it is an isotropic quadrupole. Now, for the torsion, the thing is, it's very interesting. The torsion is a great mathematical tool to describe what are dislocations. The torsion measure how parallelograms doesn't close when you go, let's say, 10 steps in this direction and 10 steps in this direction or the alternate direction, and you don't happen in the same point, and this is what dislocation does. But there is a problem with this description. The problem is, first, to any type of defects, you have a different geometrical field. For example, interstitials in this geometric description are described with non-metricity tensor. So each defect requires a different geometric field, and you end up with too many fields, and the bigger problem is that it is not clear at all how these fields integrate into the elastic problem. Can you, if I will give you the torsion tensor of a single dislocation, can you write an energy of this dislocation? And the answer is no. The torsion is a good descriptor, but it never appears in the elastic description, and it was even recently proved that it cannot appear in the elastic description. And for this reason, this metric description is much more natural. It is automatically connected to the elastic problem. So it can also be shown that a distribution of such metric dislocations, the limit of such distribution, you end up with a manifold whose connection is not symmetric, which means it has a torsion. So it is a good descriptor, but it is very weakly connected to the elastic problem. Now, okay, so it is, what I try to say is that it is important not only for crystals, but also for amorphous solids or other types of materials with elastic charges. And so specifically, I can go back to the illustration I showed at the beginning. You have an amorphous solid subjected to elastic shear, to external shear, sorry. And if the shear is large enough, you end up with a single localized plastic deformation. And what I showed you now means that this elastic charge, if we want to refer to it as elastic charge, must be at least of quadrupolar order, because the monopole and the dipole must involve plastic deformation on the scale of the system size. And this is a localized one. And if you will go to the literature and you will find simulations about molecular dynamic simulations of amorphous solids that are subjected to elastic shear, to external shear, you will find that the localized plastic deformations are exactly of quadrupolar nature. And this is a geometrical property. It is only from a simple assumption that we assume about the origin of the elastic charge. Now, for
argue that this is volume conserving is the interest here, and so you get something that looks hyperbolic in terms of the
again? Deformation. Well, I did not hear what
you have something that's locally
preserve area.
It can't look like a source or a contraction.
Yes, but you cannot. What you say is okay. If we assume something about the deformation, we can understand why it should be of this symmetry. But what I just showed is not the most surprising thing in the world. But it's just that it is a result. This is what I tried to say. So indeed, other people doesn't really need our modeling. you can also describe this deformation as SLB inclusions. And SLB inclusions are known to have quadrupolar symmetry. But so it's not, what I'm just saying is that our quadrupolar defects or quadrupolar charges are the good candidates for describing localized plastic deformations in amorphous solids.
So local shears,
yeah.
Basically, look like little.
Yeah. So you asked now, Shankara, you asked about two such elastic charges. So indeed, for example, in this example that I mentioned at the beginning of a set of contractile cells, we want to study the interaction between them. So the question, can we write the reference metric of a set of elastic charges? And the answer is yes. If you will adopt, again, the conformal representation, then this conformal factor is just the sum of them. And the reason for this is that the curvature is everywhere zero. And the curvature...
What is R? It's the polar... Okay, you...
What? Think of this as
that's discussing the
you have the
yes.
metric, the Friedian metric. Now you you have this, you choose just a system of polar coordinate system, and you can apply this swelling factor, for example.
So the R has nothing to do
okay.
with the locations.
No, no. It was better if I would just write here Euclidean metric, and this special coordinate system has nothing to do with this description. So if you want to write the reference metric of a set of defects, you will just pick a Euclidean.
That's just the curvature of a conformal metric.
And yeah, exactly. So you just need to take the sum of conformal factors that corresponds to each elastic charge. So now the question is, if I have several of them, how they interact with each other, what happens there. So how much time do I have? I'm not sure about it.
There's a lot of questions going on. So I'd say you can have till 11:30.
Okay, great, okay. So if we are interested in the mechanics of elastic charges, the thing that we should do is to solve equilibrium equations. This is the basic thing that you should do if you want to solve the problem. And here I define the stress as the variation of the energy with respect to the strain. And if you define the stress in this sense, the equilibrium equation is this one, independent of the specific form of W. The form of W appears only here. And this is a generalization of the classical equation that you know from elasticity. And the reason is that you can see that, okay, so what's written here is, this is the covariant derivative with respect to the actual metric, which is unknown. These are Christoffel symbols of the reference metric, which is known, but we also of the actual metric, which is unknown. And in fact, this is a nonlinear equation, not for sigma, but for G, because G appears in this Christoffel symbol and in this covariant derivative, and also here with from the relation between the stress and the elastic energy.
You're using the reference metric for the covariant derivative.
You could, but it will not cancel this. Instead, if you will have here covariant derivative, here you will have other Christoffel symbols with gamma and gamma bar in a different way. You cannot get rid of them.
So you're using, well, I mean, either whichever metric you use is a way to write the whole thing as a divergence. But
this is a divergence. This is a divergence, a special kind of divergence that must take into account both the reference geometry and the actual one.
So you're using the actual metric.
Both. I must. If you minimize the, if you write the Euler-Lagrange equations of the functional energy W, whatever W is, the most general W, and you define the stress in this way,
yeah,
then you end up with this equation, and it takes into account both of them.
What are you using for raising and lowering? And for
reference metric.
The reference metric.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And there are physical reasons for this. For if you want to have conserved mass, you must do it with reference metric, for example. Okay, so the problem is how to solve this, this equation. If we will solve this equation, we can do mechanics of elastic charges, okay? So the way to solve it is by generalizing the idea of a restress function, except over here it's a bit more complicated, but it can be shown that any solution of this equation can be represented in terms of a single scalar function. where this is the determinant of the actual metric, which is still unknown. This is the reference metric. These are Levi-Civita symbols, the anti-symmetric Levi-Civita symbols, and this is the covariant derivative, again, with respect to the actual metric, which is still unknown. But any solution of this equation can be represented by this form. Yes?
Those covariant derivatives don't commute, right?
Is that they commute. Or? They commute because this is actually, it is, in this case, psi is scalar, and this is only partial derivative. But for the case of three dimensions, psi will be a tensor, and then it is important to be in this order in order to describe the solution.
A little confused with the notion. So there shouldn't there be a bar on your covariant derivative up there?
No, if there was a bar,
yeah.
Here the Christoffel symbol was not lambda lambda here. It was something else that
okay.
distinguished between the two parts. I
so
wrote it in this
the
way.
The actual metric for that derivative.
So this derivative, this covariant derivative is with respect to the actual metric.
Okay.
Yes. So it can be, okay, so the first step is to prove that any solution can be represented in this form. And still it is a problem because this is the, in some sense, the unknown, and the unknown appears also in this way. So there is some technical steps that we can do, and we can define in a very precise way how to make some approximation methods. Unlike the classical one, here it is more systematic. But I will save from you the all the details, but I can say that the reference...
Just the previous equation, maybe it's important to say, it's exact.
It's exact. No linearization.
It's valid for any W.
For any constitutive relation, and it is exact. No linearizations of the strain, no linearizations in the energy, and this is exact, yes. And... Now, if we, there is a, again, I will save from you the details, but there, it is possible to make some systematic approximation methods. The actual metric can be expanded with some small parameter that we call the compatibility, the incompatibility parameter, and it depends, its precise form depends on the specific problem. The stress function can be expanded in the, similarly, and if you will, write the compatibility, the geometric compatibility condition, you'll do all, everything correct, you will end up with this equation for the first order stress function, which is a very beautiful equation, as you can see. And the special example of reference geometry that is Euclidean, like the classical elasticity, corresponds to 0k bar. And if k bar is 0, you see that all these terms fall, and you end up with a biharmonic equation for the stress function as you know from classical elasticity of a stress function. But you can now do it for non-trivial intrinsic geometries. And we can do take some further approximation of small interacting charges, meaning that the reference curvature is of order of eta. And in this case, this equilibrium equation reduces back to a very simple form where the reference curvature now is a source for the stress function. And a nice result is that in this case, we have a very strong similarity analogy with electrostatics. If you now write the elastic energy in terms of the stress function, you end up with this equation, where psi is our potential, and k bar is our charge, very similar to electrostatics. So for this reason, we can now express interactions between elastic charges. So if you have, I will answer in a minute, if you have two charges, and you want to calculate the interaction between them, you only need to take the stress function that induced by one, the potential of one, multiply it by the curvature of the other, and integrate, and you have here a list of possible singularities of the curvature and the corresponding stress functions, and now you can calculate interactions, for example, between quadrupolar defect and a monopole, or quadrupole and a dipole, and many types of interactions. Yes.
I'm curious, there must be some advantage here in using the stress function that you're using. There's a very simple equation for the conformal factor. If you go back to your conformal equation, right, the
yeah.
Gauss equation has this very simple form for, you know, there's like a del squared phi and a
yes.
k e to the phi. And so
how
is that not useful here?
The conformal factor describes the intrinsic geometry. It says nothing about elasticity. So, for example, you take the conformal factor of a monopole, it just tells you that the intrinsic geometry is that of a monopole, of a cone, for example, But it says nothing about elasticity. If you want to solve the elastic problem, you need to minimize the elastic energy, which means you need to solve the equilibrium equation, and this is a way to solve it. What I presented is a different calculation. The conformal factor is an intrinsic metric. This is one part, and this solution is solving the actual metric.
But one could relate the conformal factor to the Gaussian curvature, the Gaussian curve.
To the reference one, not to the real one. The real one is zero. We are talking about planar configuration with zero Gaussian curvature. So this equation, maybe I should tell this, this equation, its physical meaning is our configuration is planar. You should put here minus and equal to zero, equal to zero Gaussian curvature of the actual configuration. This is what this equation says.
Which is a trivial solution without any loads, it will be just psi equals zero, no stresses.
Again, what is the question?
This the solution will be psi 1 equals really zero.
If k bar is zero and you have free boundary conditions, psi will be zero.
So the only source for frustration or stresses is
exactly.
K bar. Okay.
Exactly, yes.
We go to the previous slide and have this expression for energy. So in order to get this expression for energy, you did some integration by parts for...
Yes, and you have boundary terms, yes.
So then there is a boundary term. So does this boundary term only go away if you have like free stress boundary conditions?
So if you have boundary conditions,
yeah.
These terms, this is a great question. I will not go by then, but if you have boundary conditions, then they should balance traction terms in the energy. Okay? So you have boundary terms that should be balanced by tractions, and you have this energy that should be minimized independently.
Is that also true if the defect is at the boundary?
I'm trying to think about what is the defect on the boundary.
Well, you have a surface and you...
Yes, for example, in the case of a cone, it's... So I think that there is an assumption here about, okay, clearly I assumed small incompatibility, and if your defect is in the boundary, I'm not sure. I need to think about it. What it means to how it is limited. Okay. So now we can calculate interaction between many type of elastic charges, and this takes us best to the motivation. And now we can calculate interaction between contractile cells and calculate from this their collective behavior, and we actually published some interesting results about a phase diagram for possible interaction between different contractile cells depending on their fraction of... So they are more complicated charges. They have both the quadrupolar part and both the isotropic part. So the exact form of the elastic charge of each cell result with a different effective interaction between them. Again, if you have higher order singularities, like here, higher quadrupoles, they can be easily described with our formulation with the appropriate multiple. Now, for the failure of amorphous solids, we also calculated interaction between localized plastic deformations with external stress and with other possible defects in amorphous solids, and this helped us to solve a problem that was about why adding a small amount of atoms to an amorphous metal dramatically increases its toughness. So the same formalism helped us to solve this problem. And now I will want to focus and give you a small taste about the mechanics of kirigami and how the formulation that I showed you is related with fictitious charges and holes. Okay, so you can think about this problem, and when I started to work with Mark and David, David suggested maybe we can start, instead of thinking about this whole problem, as a set of frames. And let's first understand the problem of a single hole, whether it is circular or square or a slit, and later we will try to understand what happens to the whole sheet. So I started to play with this with such frames. And I found that if I want to understand it, I first need to understand the plane stress problem. And the reason I can show you now, consider, for example, a circular frame. There will be no real difference. So if you want to solve this plane stress of a circular frame where the inner edge is free and the outer is subjected to external stress in this form, for example, this is shear just rotated in 45 degrees, then you simply need to solve the re-stress, for the re-stress function and require boundary conditions. This is a classical problem, very easily solved. But I suggest to solve it differently. Instead of solving it only on this annulus, we can solve it everywhere, including inside, when now I'm allowed for elastic charges to form inside the hole. It is identical to the classical method of fictitious electric charges or the mirror, the method of images. So if you will do it, you will find that in order to balance boundary conditions here, you need fictitious elastic charge that is has two components. This is the quadrupole. This Laplacian with the tilde in Cartesian coordinates, it's simply dxx minus dyy instead of plus. Okay, so you have this is the singularity of a pure quadrupole, and you have a hexadecapole term which is less important, as I will show you in a minute. But when I now see that deforming a frame in this way result with hexadecapole.
So it's like 8, 16.
Four times four.
Okay.
So how does the dimension work out of beta and alpha dimensional?
So alpha is proportional. Okay, so what you find is that alpha is proportional to the external stress, and the quadrupole charge have the dimension of length squared, so it is divided by the Young's modulus and multiplied by the area. Okay? And what we... Okay, so what it means is that if now I have a manifold with a elastic charge, I can think about this charge as a defect. And this takes me back to the work by... And the thing that, before I'm moving to the next slide, you should know that the lowest possible charge is always the quadrupolar. Monopole and dipole can be formed only with plastic deformations, violent plastic deformations, like removing wedges or inducing constant shifts along radial lines. So I can think about such objects with holes as objects with quadrupolar defects inside. And this takes me to the work by David Nelson and Sebastian Sang. They showed us that if you have a flexible membrane with defects, and defects we know, they are simply elastic charges, they will adapt three-dimensional shapes that screen out the elastic charge. So the reason is that in the stress, the equation for the stress state is of this form, where K bar is our elastic charge, and K is the actual curvature, and you can pick K that equal to K bar in order to have zero stress, and just to have an isometric embedding in three dimension with paying only bending and not stretching. So this implies that we will want to screen out our fictitious charge by adapting actual Gaussian curvature that is quadrupolar. It will screen it out. And as you can see, this is exactly what happens. If you take the paper, you pull it out, you can see that at the corners, you have, this is a simulation, at the corners you have four disclinations, partial disclinations because they are on the boundaries. And these are like positive disclinations, these are negatives. And you can...
Can you explain why this is positive?
Okay, so if you have, you look on these two edges, what happened is that you started with some right angle, and now it is smaller. It's like removing a wedge. And here it is exactly the opposite. So here you have positive disclination and here negative. But the nice thing is that if we assume that we want to screen out the fictitious quadrupole, we can calculate the quadrupole. We know what is this size. So we can calculate what should be the disclination at each corner that will induce the quadrupole that will screen out the fictitious one. I'll just finish the argument. And you can see that if you now assume that you have four conical shapes at the vicinities of the corners with the calculated disclinations, and you compare them with the simulation, you end up with a no-fitting parameter, exactly the same energies. And this shows the energy density, which shows exactly that the energy localizes near the corner in order to form the four disclinations that will screen out the fictitious quadrupole. Yes?
Yeah,
I'm curious, if you think of this surface, the edge of regression of this surface is going to be, I'm guessing, four continuous curves, or maybe two, I don't know, some set of continuous curves external to the surface. And to some extent, you're describing the singularity structure here as discrete sets of points. And I'm wondering how to...
Okay, so originally there should not be discrete set of discrimination. The reason that you have here discrete set of discrimination is because of a different reason. Also in electrostatics, the electrostatic analog is easier, but then I can explain what happens here. So the analog in electrostatics is that you have, for example, a spherical shell, conductive one, subjected to uniform external electric field. You will end up with a fictitious dipole inside. Now, this corresponds to a distribution of charges on the shell that is continuous one, whose total multiple is the dipole one. Now, we assume that you will have not a circular shape, but one with like the square. So you know that elastic charges tend to localize near the corners. This is exactly what happens here. So if you will you will calculate what happens in a circular one, a circular hole, you will have a distribution, a smooth distribution of declinations whose net quadrupole is identical to the fictitious one, and you can now calculate how the distribution of declinations give rise to the right configuration. It is much easier in this case because now the shape of the hole makes the declination to localize near the edges, and this is the reason that we have a perfect agreement. In the circular case, if I will pick only four declinations, it will be less similar to the simulation.
But you can calculate it, though, right?
Yes, yes.
Have you tried the experiment?
Of circular? Yes, I have many figures. I just didn't put them. Yes, so now the idea, okay, so the main goal was to go to the Kirigami structure, the set array of holes.
Yeah. Have you moved to three dimensions now for this problem?
So what I said, yes, I said, okay, in the plane stress problem, which is two-dimensional, I can calculate the fictitious charges induced by the external loads. Now I assume that in three dimensions, based on the work of David Nelson and Sebastian Tsang, they showed that you can adapt a configuration with extrinsic Gaussian curvature that will screen out the defect, the elastic charge. And under this assumption, I now assume that I will have configurations that have four declinations that will induce quadrupoles that will screen out the fictitious one. And in this way, I can calculate the bending energy of such conical shapes near the corners, and you find this result of the three-dimensional, the energy of three-dimensional shapes compared with the simulation. Now, the idea was to go to the array of frames to understand the Kirigami. And just again, it's only a taste. I will not explain everything, and it is still a work in progress. But you can see that if you have this kind of array, the quadrupoles are oriented with this way. And now you have interactions between these neighbors. They are completely happy because the interaction between quadrupoles want to do something like this, or something like this. The sum of their angle measured from their connecting line want to be pi over 2. And this is why this array is, you have perfect compatibility between two neighboring holes. However, here, if the orientation of quadrupoles in this direction, these two quadrupoles that are like this have positive interaction energy, and this is why this array is frustrated, and this is the reason for which the Kirigami structure that I showed you here shows it's like a collective excitation of screening quadrupoles. It is worse to form them because they reduce the energy. In the other array, they increase the energy, and therefore you will end up with effectively only planar quadrupoles and not the extrinsic one. So this is still a work in progress. I have other things to show, but I guess that I don't have time, so I'll finish here.
So
So if you can go two slides back. So you describe this as a matter of interaction between quadrupoles, which causes when you pull along one direction to have a large response or a low energy, and along the perpendicular, the 45 degrees direction to have a very stiff response, let's say. But that, I guess, appears if you only have one, right? If you take your square frame and pull it diagonally, you get this response. If you pull it from the two straight sides, you also have this problem, even though...
No, you can think, for example, of here pulling from this point, just to understand it, if you pull from these two points, you will have here the positive declinations and here the negative ones. You still buckle if you do it from points. So you can ask, why should I do it by points? So I can tell you that even if you will do here, just put here small cuts and let them be connected with only on a small region, it still will not change very much the total response because of the incompatibility between their interactions. So it is not the way you pull a single one, it is mostly because of the interaction. But you are right, it seems that you have two effects to take into account, but my claim is that the interaction between them is a dominant one.
And also regarding that, if you only do it with one, then as you said, the charges will appear on the side.
So they will be much more smooth, of course, because you don't have corners. So here you have a distribution of declinations, positive ones here. Here you will have negative declinations here. And this corner will still attract some declinations, but because it's corner. Yes.
So in the next one, in the bottom picture, so we should understand that in every junction you put, you nucleate a new quadrupole.
In every junction or in every hole? In every hole.
The fictitious one, but you said that the declination appears.
So here you will have not. Okay, so you say here you will have quadrupoles.
In the cross.
Between four,
yes.
Okay.
Here you put a quadrupole because it reduces the energy.
In this picture you cannot. Here you can. This is maybe a good way to say it. Here you have positive declinations, and here you have negative declination. It forms a quadrupole. So you can form real quadrupoles in order to screen out the fictitious one. But here you cannot because the declination form here and here, and not in the junction. So this is the way to probably. So the declination is formed on this in the middle here. It is a distribution around the middle. So you have positive declination here, positive declination here. The negative one is formed here. So in these junctions, you end up with something that is complicated and not a quadrupole. And this, you don't have the structure that will screen out the quadrupoles. Unlike in this case, where at this tip and this tip you have positive declination. At these two tips, you have negative declination. In a way, you have an effective quadrupole that screen out the fictitious one. Okay? So the structure of the array, okay, so given an array, before doing any experiment, you can estimate in which positions declinations will form, and you can now ask, are these configurations of the declinations induce negative interaction energy or positive one? And if it's positive one, it is frustrated, like in this case. And if it is negative, it will probably induce soft modes of deformation.
So in the case that's not frustrated on the top, does that mean you can cut something and it will...
It means that if you will just pull and you will compare the response of the material with or without the hole, with the holes you will have a much smaller effective Young's modulus. They will buckle out and you will have, it's like a collective behavior of quadrupoles that are formed in order to help you deform the material along this direction.
The formation of holes allows you to form this fictitious quadrupole that will screen the quadrupoles you would like to make. Right?
Mm-hmm. Whereas in the bottom case, if you measure the Young's modulus, it will be the same for the...
It will be a bit less. It will be a bit less because of the fact that you removed area.
Yeah.
And the fact that you have mechanism that will respond differently for each hole, but it will be similar to the response of each hole in plane rather than the out of plane response.
I think you mentioned it, I just wanted to make sure. The analogy with electrostatics is only exact in the small eta limit, right?
In again, in what?
The small eta limit.
So yes.
Okay.
In the higher order, you have corrections, and maybe you should also, in this way, correct electrostatics. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But yes, the lowest order, it is identical. It is very similar to electrostatics. The higher order can be calculated very easily. There is no higher complication, but it results with corrected potentials and corrected interaction. Yes.
One more question for a hole. There is this for cracks. If you make a penny-shaped hole into a solid, and if you stretch, then you can describe it also as a sort of the stress field as a superposition of a certain dislocation density, which has singularities at the edges of the.
So the origin for this, yes, the origin for the what you described is exactly this. Okay, I should probably mention a work done by Randy Kemian and Sabeta Matsumoto. She studied the array of holes by saying, okay, if we have a single hole, and a single hole go to an ellipse, it's like putting a dipole here and a dipole here. Not a dipole, a dislocation here and a dislocation here. From our point of view, a dislocation is just a dipole, and this is why these are quadrupoles. So also Sabeta described holes like quadrupoles, and in cracks you have distributions of dipole, which are their first non-zero moment is the quadrupole. This work shows what is the origin of these charges, and it can tell you exactly what is the charge. So, for example, the hexadecapole that achieved analytically have no analog in other works, but if you have very large holes close together, the hexadecapole will be much more important than the quadrupole because it has larger singularity, and we are close. Not the quadrupole is important, but the higher order. So they are related, and this is actually the origin for these relations.
What happens if you just replace these squares with circles?
So there will
be direction. So what would you do?
So again, there will be a difference, but the difference will not be drastic because it doesn't. As long as you will take a convex shape of a hole, you will induce inside the quadrupole whose magnitude is again proportional to its area, and with the same from scaling arguments you can find it, and you will find a slightly different behavior because of the mechanics of a single cell. It is a bit different, but the collective behavior will be generally the same, and you will have a softening.
Why
quadrupole? But because we showed why not higher multipole, because okay, so it can be shown that first thing to show is that the lowest order possible is the quadrupole. Second thing to show is that the magnitude of the quadrupole is proportional to the area of the hole. So both can be shown, and this is why the lowest order is always the quadrupole. The magnitude of the quadrupole can be shown if you want on.
I would agree with the hole with the ellipticals, but the circle.
It depends on the boundary conditions. If you have, tensile boundary conditions on a circular hole, you will end up with a quadrupole, isotropic quadrupole, hexadecapole, and even another one. So you can calculate them.
So it means that calculating
them. How to calculate them, you ask? So it's take us back to the fictitious charges here. Instead of solving for the Aristarchus stress function on the annulus, if you also have here a different shape, you can solve in the complete manifold without the hole, while allowing for fictitious charges to form here. And the question now is, which elastic charges should you put here in order to balance boundary conditions. And the quadrupole will be always necessary. It can be shown by just direct calculation. You cannot cancel it, no matter what the shape of the hole. But it requires some calculation. It shows that it cannot be balanced. So the lowest order is always the quadrupole. You cannot eliminate it. Never.
It makes sense because the boundary conditions are corresponding to shear. So
it's like asking now in electrostatics. I have a shape that is different than this circle, a conductive circular shell, and I want to put a uniform electric field. Can I find a shape of the conductive shell that will not be circular in a way that will remove the image dipole and I will left only with fictitious quadrupole? It is impossible because the image picture of a uniform field is always the dipole. The shape will add some higher order multiples that will fix the boundary condition.
So this means that alpha is independent on the shape?
No, it depends on the shape, but its scaling is independent in the, so it scales like length square, so any shape has some length, some scale of length. For example, a slit, it has zero area, but it has a quadrupole. It is the length of the slit.
But there is possibly, so there is prefactor.
Numerical prefactor depends on the shape.
Probably there is a minimum value of the prefactor which is larger than zero if you minimize over all possible shapes.
Yes.
Actually, I think what he said is true. You should get something that only depends on the total shear and total area or something. It cannot depend that much on the details.
This is the minimum value. But
so this is the minimum one. But if you will take other shapes,
Does it mean perfectly?
So what do you mean by skin perfectly? The circular one is, okay, for any shape you have fictitious charge. Each fictitious charge should balance boundary conditions on this inner edge. So I don't know what is better. Better for what? To have a smaller quadrupole? It will always depend on the size.
It's also in the electrostatic analog system. So suppose, as you said, you have an electrostatic field, uniform one, and now you make some hole. And you want to know what is the magnitude of the dipole moment.
It doesn't depend on...
It does depend.
It depends.
It depends on the boundary shape.
It can depend on shape, but very weakly. It will depend.
What do you mean? I mean, it depends.
It will be one point something.
It's just dimension-wise. You don't get it, right? I mean, so...
So electric field is...
Electric field is not in the same dimension as these two.
You're right. But you're saying that there is no shape that would result in alpha is equal to zero. That,
no.
You know, quadrupole with zero, you don't have higher order.
Okay, depends on the boundary conditions. Of course, if I'll take a slit, and now I'll put these boundary conditions, the boundary conditions will induce zero quadrupole inside, but they will not induce higher order quadrupole. So if you have any higher order quadrupole, you must have also the quadrupole. You cannot have octupole alone.
I'm still confused by this discrete description.
Yes.
Whereas in the sense, I mean, if you look at these surfaces, and if they have no Gaussian curvature, right?
You mean the three-dimensional shapes of the pooled frames?
Sure, right. Okay. They have no Gaussian curvature. If you extend the generators of these surfaces, you'll end up with basically a singularity structure for the surface. You'll end up with the edge of regression. Like basically, if you continue to extend these surfaces any farther, you'll need to introduce Gaussian curvature along some set of curves. It won't be one continuous curve. It'll be a set. And so, in some sense, your discrete description must be an effective description of that continuous structure.
What discrete? I'm not sure I understand what is discrete.
The fact that you have discretization just at those corners.
You have a discrete set of charges.
Yes,
right?
Okay.
Not a continuing. You don't have a line.
So it will not be good for any, for all limits of the experiments. For example, if I will take a very small hole, then this approximation starts to be invalid.
I guess the point is even here it's an approximation, right? It's not that you only have these four
components. I mentioned it. I mentioned that you have a distribution.
Yeah.
I mentioned that you have a distribution of disclinations. And like in electrostatic, the disclinations tends to localize near the edges. But what I showed is that surprisingly, it works very good. But I also mentioned that for the circular hole, it will be different. The assuming singular disclinations will not be enough because there, in this situation of the circular hole, the distribution is very smooth.
Okay. So I'm wondering if these places where you're you know judiciously placing multipoles and things to approximate it, whether these correspond to interesting features of the edge of regression, the cusps
to
of
the
edge
cusps.
Of regression.
Exactly, to the cusps.
Or other
cusps here.
There will be four cusps anyway. Also in the
they could be other cusps. Not far in.
Anyway, I'm interested in trying to connect those two pictures.
Mm-hmm.
We
can think about it. I'm not sure I understand, but
I think we need to conclude now. Let's thank Michael once again. Before we break, our Deputy Director, Greg Huber.
Since it's our last official meeting for the SHEETS program, I wanted to thank the coordinators, almost all of whom are still in the room. I think we lost one a couple minutes ago. But they put together a great program, and it extended for many, many weeks, and I think we had almost 100 people come through or something. So it was a really landmark program, I think, for the KITP. So thank you, coordinators, for putting it all together. And now go write your excerpt.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for the KITP board and
yes.
So moving and so